And we will now call the next case. Number 20-11141, Alabama Aircraft Industries, Inc. versus Boeing Company.
Thank you, Your Honor. Lori Webb Daniel here, representing Alabama Aircraft, also known as PEMCO. And I'll refer to my client as PEMCO for purposes of this argument. I'd like to start by addressing the question posed by the court a few weeks ago, and I thank the court for that, and I actually thank Boeing for its supplemental authorities submitted yesterday evening, because what this has done has caused me to focus even more in on this question. And so the court cited some case law, the Etheridge decision cited by the court is, I think, the most important decision on this issue. It looks to the Alabama test for determining whether a statute of limitations is procedural, and thus the law of the forum controls, or whether it is substantive. Now, the test it's sometimes called a built-in test, but it's called that because the test is, in effect, where you have a statute of creation setting out a claim, cause of action statutorily. The limitation period is so inextricably bound up with the statute, in the statute creating the right, then that's a substantive statute of limitations and the substantive law of that state applies. It's often referred to as a built-in statute of limitations, and where you have a built-in statute of limitations, it is substantive. Now, there's a somewhat recent district court decision out of the Northern District of Alabama. It's Johnson versus BPS Direct at 2020 Westlaw 6395571. And the reason I like that decision, Your Honors, is because it gives the history, the evolution, the history of this rule in Alabama. And it discusses Etheridge. It discusses the Alabama Supreme Court's decision in Sanders. And before that, Battles. All of those are built-in statutes of limitations. Let me just turn before any more time passes to the statute we're dealing with now. Missouri Uniform Trade Secrets Act. That's at 417.461. It's titled Time Limitation, and then it's also got something about continuing misappropriation. And it's important because it says in mandatory language that the claim shall be brought within 5 years of when the misappropriation was discovered or could have been. But it also goes on and says a continuing misrepresentation constitutes a single claim. It is defining the claim. What is a claim? And of course, you also have other statutory provisions. You've got the statute mutes, as we call it. It has statutory definition of trade secrets, defining the claim. It provides new claims for royalties for misappropriation, defines, clarifies statutory. It's got creates a punitive damages claim, which has its own standard, evil motive.
If I can fast forward you a little bit, let's assume I agree with you with where you're headed or where you've been headed, that it's substantive for purposes of the statute of limitations under the analysis in Etheridge. Still then we have to apply the lex loci delecti test under Alabama law, correct?
Your Honor, we argue that as an alternative, but if you do agree that the Alabama lex, place of the last event, that's what the Alabama case law has established, and that's what the U.S. Bank decision was all about.
Can I back up for a second? Why is that an alternative? Because as I understand it, so our decision of whether the statute of limitations is procedural or substantive takes us down one of two roads. If it's procedural, then it's clear that Alabama law applies, the two-year statute of limitation applies, and then we would affirm the district court. If it's substantive, that doesn't end the question, does it? And correct me if I'm wrong, I'm asking, I don't know. As I understand it, if it's substantive, then we ask under Alabama's choice of law, under the lex loci delecti, which state's law applies, Missouri or Alabama. Do I have that right? Or if it's substantive, you win and that's it.
Either way, Your Honor, either way, because here we have misappropriation and that claim becomes actionable upon the misappropriation, which the record shows occurred at Boeing's headquarters in St. Louis, Missouri. That's where the, you know, the
there still needs to be damage though, doesn't there?
No, Your Honor, actually not. You can have a claim for injunctive relief. And then in addition, I mean, royalties are you know, a payment of the enrichment, the, you know, what the, it's a measurement of what the other side gained, not necessarily a loss. So the claim does not require an injury, a financial injury, that sort of thing. And this is consistent.
Isn't it, you have to show injury, but not damages. Is that your argument?
Well, there's injury.
Injury, yes. Would be
Your
an element
Honor,
of the
thank
claim.
Thank you, Your Honor. It's not financial injury that you have to show necessarily. The harm occurs when somebody steals your property. And that's Alabama law conversion, as well as other types of misappropriation. It's just very well established. It's where that happens, where someone, you know, converts, where they steal the property. And that happened at the command center at the St. Louis headquarters. It occurred in Missouri. So therefore, under that analysis, Missouri.
Well, the theft would have happened in Missouri, but wouldn't the injury have happened in where that person was injured, in the sense at headquarters in Alabama?
Your Honor, the injury is when somebody steals your property, that injures you. And so that's why stealing the proprietary information in Missouri puts Missouri there as.
Well, let me ask it this way. Imagine, you know, we're not talking about trade secrets, but instead just flat cash. So I have cash that's sitting in a bank deposit box in a local bank in Missouri. Somebody goes in and takes that money from my bank account in Missouri or my safe deposit box and puts it in their home. Where am I? I understand the theft happened in Missouri, but aren't I injured in my home? In other words, I am now short in my home $100,000 that I didn't have before, right?
Your Honor, you're injured when the property is taken. And that's right. Consistent with Alabama law, and we've cited cases.
There's no doubt that. There's no doubt you're right on the when. I just, the where I am injured, aren't I injured where I am? And that is,
it's where the last act occurs that gives rise to the claim, and that is the theft gives rise to the claim. So I also would like to mention the choice of law provision. This is a broad choice of law. It is not looking to just interpretation of the contract. It's also looking at the rights and relations of the parties. So for that reason, it designates Missouri law, so it should apply. I'd like to save my remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Ms. Daniel. Counsel for Boeing, you may begin. You're muted, sir. Still muted.
Sorry, go ahead.
There we go.
Sorry, Your Honor. We have a double mute system to ensure that we are not heard when we're not supposed to be. So I'm here now. Thank you. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Craig Primus. I represent Boeing, the appellee cross appellant in the case. Addressing first the trade secret claim, that dismissal should be affirmed because Alabama's two-year statute of limitations applies, and it applies for two reasons. First, as the district court held below, under the party's contract in Alabama's lex loci doctrine, Alabama law applies to a tort claim like this one. And second, as this court pointed out with its question to the parties, in Alabama, statutes of limitations are presumptively procedural, such that the Alabama limitation period will apply unless another state's limitation period is part of a statute of creation. And by definition, and I believe Ms. Daniels left this out, a statute of creation only exists where it creates a new cause of action that did not exist at common law. That is the other part of the test established by the Alabama Supreme Court in cases like Precision Gear and Etheridge. And we provided two cases last night that are closely analogous here. We have Judge Heikkila's decision in Reese, which surveys the history of Alabama Supreme Court law on statutes of creation and notably recognizes the requirement that it create a new cause of action that didn't exist at common law. And then we provided a district court case in Illinois, which applies the statute of creation doctrine to this very situation, looking at statutes of limitation in connection with trade secrets acts. And there the court held that it was procedural because the act codified pre-existing common law. And that's clearly the case with Missouri. We provided a Supreme Court.
Counsel, can I ask you about the contract first before you continue with this? Because obviously yes, the contract is clear. We don't need to get to this part of it. So the contract has, you know, two clauses that relate to choice of law. The first is relating to interpretation of the contract. We all agree that that doesn't apply here, at least with regard to in terms of the choice of law analysis. The second part deals with the rights and obligations of the parties to the agreement. Why is PEMCO's right not to have its property appropriated and Boeing's obligation to make sure that it's not that the property is not misappropriated and its obligation to pay or to compensate if it is not included as part of that?
Well, as a matter of contract, the contract claim for the taking of that property would be covered by Missouri law, and that fits within the plain language of the statute. The question presented is whether that extends to a separate tort claim that does not have a breach of contract or any requirement of a contract under Missouri law as an element of the claim. So it's separate and independent, and it's a tort claim. The plain language of this provision clearly refers to this agreement twice. The agreement on its face, the scope
of problem. Here's the problem with that analysis, though, counsel. What it says in that clause is the rights and obligations of the parties to the agreement. So when it says to the agreement, it's modifying parties, not modifying the rights and obligations. So in other words, the rights and obligations are not those that are defined in the agreement, as you've read it, and this is just my own reading. The rights and obligations, as I read it, the to the agreement refers to those of the parties. And here it's clear that one party has a right not to have its property misappropriated, and the other part has an obligation to ensure that's not the case, and also to compensate if it is. So I guess my question to you again is, why would that not be covered by this clause?
Yes, Your Honor, I think really three responses. The first is the provision itself, just focusing on Section 11, refers to interpretation of the agreement and interpretation of the rights and liabilities of the parties to the agreement.
That's not a fair reading because interpretation doesn't modify rights and obligations. It would if there was a comma set off after interpretation, maybe, but I don't see how under the disbursement, the way we disperse verbs or nouns and sentences that this would apply to that. So I'm having trouble understanding that. What are your other two?
I understand. Yes, Your Honor. This NDA agreement has to be looked at in context. And if you take a step back, the parties entered into a memorandum of agreement, which governed the parties' business relationship to jointly bid on the KC-135 contract. That's the master agreement. On its face in Section 15, that says that the contract is governed by the law of the state of Missouri. It does not extend to tort claims. And then the NDA is incorporated into the MOA. And so, and the MOA provisions apply to it.
Doesn't the fact that it is a different, that the parties went out of its way to say, not just refer back to the clause that's in the main contract or track the same exact language, but instead added something, a strong indication that added something includes what I said, what I asked at the beginning, which is the right of one party not to have its property misappropriated and the right of another part, the obligation of the other party to make sure that doesn't happen and to compensate if it does.
Your Honor, I don't agree with that because the NDA, again, on its face says that the only purpose of the NDA is to create obligations limited to those expressly set forth in the contract.
So that's an interesting point, too. I have to say, when I first read that argument in your brief, I was really convinced by it. But then looking at it, that language refers to, and it's done a few times, rights and liabilities. And it's rights and liabilities under this agreement. And that phrase is actually used a couple of times. This phrase is different. It's not rights and liabilities under this agreement. It's rights and obligations. And it's not under this agreement. It's to the parties to this agreement. And doesn't that difference also seem to indicate that it's meant something different than that term of art that's used earlier and is broader than that?
No, Your Honor. I think if you read the choice of law provision in the context of the whole agreement, when we refer to those two other provisions to talk about the rights and obligations of the parties, it makes sense. The contract is creating rights and obligations. Then when you go to the choice of law provision, which is going to be addressed to situations where there's a potential breach of the contract or a disagreement over the under the contract, it turns into liabilities. And there the flip
it's actually,
side of
it's
the
actually
same
flipped.
Coin.
It's rights and liabilities earlier in the contract and it's obligations under the clause, but you have that flipped. But I understand
what yes, that's what I'm saying. And the liabilities and obligations are just flip sides of the same coin legally. And where you have liabilities in the choice, I believe it's liabilities in the choice of law provision. And that makes sense because that's where you would address what law applies to the liabilities. And the obligations is where it's the contract on its face sets forth what it's creating. And so
let me ask you this. I guess I have a similar question to what Judge Luck asked, but a little bit differently, which is how in your reading of this phrase, the interpretation of this agreement and the rights and liabilities of the parties to this agreement, where's a separate, something separate that rights and liabilities of the parties to this agreement, what does it do that the interpretation of this agreement wouldn't do? Does that make sense?
Sure. It does make sense, Your Honor. Let me address that. So for instance, the agreement has a limitation of liability provision. That provision might require construction or interpretation of particular terms. What does it mean? There's a separate legal question as to whether that type of term is enforceable under a state's law. And that would be addressed to the rights and obligations of the party. It may not require any construction or interpretation. The provision could be clear as day. It's just a question of whether a particular state would enforce, say, an exculpatory clause or some other type of clause. So there is independent content to the rights and liabilities phrase. And what I'm trying to express is that reading it to be limited to contract claims and not tort claims makes sense when you look at it in the context of a contract where it's really just incorporated by reference into a master agreement. It'd be very odd to have a subsidiary agreement open up tort claims where the main contract specifically says that it doesn't. And
counsel,
so the best way to harmonize them is to read them together.
Counsel, it seems to be a false choice, though, to say it either is all torts or nothing. I don't think we need to go that far, read it that far, and read it as an arising under or related to clause, which would incorporate every tort under the sun, to say that this particular statutory cause of action is a right or obligation that's referenced to the parties to the agreement. I mean, that seems to be different things. You would agree with me?
No, I don't, because there's no real logical stopping point to the appellant's argument. If it relates, extends to the rights and liabilities of the parties,
that's not true. I mean, we have case law, and so do lots of others, that the arising under or related to can even be to third-party beneficiaries that aren't even part of the contract. In other words, that language is broad enough to include people that aren't even parties. Here, we're only talking about the rights and obligations of the parties. And I think that's constrained by those rights and obligations that are created under the agreement, including the right to not have things misappropriated and for the obligation to make sure that those things aren't disclosed. I mean, it seems to me that that's the limiting principle, isn't it?
Well, I don't see that in the language as it's read or advanced by the appellant, Your Honor. And I would also suggest that in the 11th Circuit, there we cited the precedent, which shows that the prototypical language for conveying breadth and an intention to go beyond the contract and bring in tort claims is arising under or related to the contract. That language is wholly absent here. So where you have a master agreement that's limited to contract, you have the NDA itself saying it's expressly limited to the rights and obligations set forth in that contract. This would be a very odd way to single out one particular tort claim and have that apply. It's not the most natural reading of this contract by far, whereas it can all be harmonized to be read as applying Missouri law just to claims under the contract or claims for breach of the contract or interpretation of the contract. And I would say that this discussion is also parallel to the alternative ground that this this statute is procedural. Missouri, I believe I was saying before that Missouri had applied a trade secrets tort for decades. And we cited a case to this court last night that indicates that the Missouri Uniform Trade Secrets Act incorporated the pre-existing case law under the restatement of torts that governed pre-existing claims. That's the analysis in Flavorchem, and we believe that Judge Heikkilä's decision in Reese would reach the exact same outcome because, by definition, that makes it not a statute of creation.
Let me ask you a question, or to address, I guess, two cases. The one from the Sixth Circuit, Bonnick, I guess is the way you pronounce that, and then the one from the Fourth Circuit, Hitachi Credit, because I'm sure you've got responses to those. I guess I'll just presage this by saying I agree with you that the normal way you would incorporate tort law is by saying, you know, any and all dispute arising between the parties or whatever. But the Sixth Circuit in Bonnick said all rights and obligations of the parties hereto shall be governed by and construed in accordance with the laws of the state of Georgia was enough to cover some torts. That's very similar to the language we have here. And the Fourth Circuit in Hitachi Credit, the rights and obligations of the parties hereunder said, you know, that was enough to cover some tort claims too. So what do you say about those two cases?
Certainly, Your Honor. With regard to Bannock, there the claim was for fraud in the inducement of the contract, and it was to entirely undo the contract. And the court there explicitly said that had the claims only been tangentially related to the franchise relationship, we would be much more inclined to find the choice of law provision not applicable. So I actually don't agree that Bannock would come out right under Alabama law, but even accepting it, what it stands for is the proposition that if you're trying to undo the contract entirely, that would be a claim affecting the relationship to the parties to the contract. But they said if it was a different claim, like the one we have, they didn't say this, but the one we have here, where contract is in no way a part of the elements of the cause of action, just a separate and independent tort, the reasoning in Bannock would not apply here. And that's true of most of the cases that Alabama Aircraft cites in support of their position, where there's a claim that the contract itself is invalid or unenforceable. And that's not what we have here.
What about the Hitachi Credit case? I mean, you'd say the same thing there, I guess.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. Are there any other questions on the Alabama Aircraft's appeal, or should I turn with my time left to the spoliation claim? Your Honors, we ask that the court reverse the jury verdict and remand back to the district court for a new trial in light of the erroneous rulings in the district court's spoliation order. The spoliation doctrine of Rule 37E and this court gives the district court an important gatekeeper role given the highly prejudicial nature of an adverse inference instruction. And that adverse inference instruction may only be given if two important criteria are met, that the duty to preserve had been triggered and that a party deleted that information with the intent to deprive. We have set forth in our brief why we think both of those rulings are wrong, but allow me, with the time I have left, just to talk about the intent to deprive. On that part, the district court's ruling is summarized in a paragraph. And in that paragraph, the district court explicitly states that he was left to speculate as to why the data was destroyed. Speculation as to why data has gone missing is, by definition, not available for an adverse inference instruction under Rule 37E. Rule 37E says that negligence is not enough. It says that gross negligence is not enough. And if I may just conclude,
Can I ask you a question about that? I want you to be able to respond to this because this is an issue I have with the spoliation. The district court here did something somewhat different, I guess, where the district court basically just gave the jury the law on spoliation. You know, the instruction says if you find that Boeing was anticipating litigation and that Boeing deleted this information with the intent to deprive, then you may infer that the lost information was unfavorable to Boeing. If you don't make these findings, don't infer it. I guess it's your position, and I just, that instruction was improper because it's required that the court make those findings and not the jury? Is that basically the heart of your position, that judges have to make those findings themselves and they can't kind of kick that to the jury to make those findings?
Yes, Your Honor. Rule 37E, the plain language of Rule 37E, says that the court has to make those findings initially before it may instruct the jury, using that language that Your Honor quoted about inferring that the lost information was unfavorable to a party.
I guess my point is usually the instruction that you give after spoliation is, you know, because you would say something like, because Boeing destroyed this material, you may infer that the loss of information was bad for Boeing, right? That would be the usual instruction. Here, that's not the instruction that the court gave. It gave an instruction that said, if you make these findings, which you suggest the judge had to make, then you may infer. And I guess my point is, it's just unusual, but what is improper necessarily about telling the jury, you can make these findings if you want to?
Well, Your Honor, Rule 37E and the advisory committee notes are explicit that this is a court comment on the deletion of evidence and to suggest that the jury that it could have been deleted because it was unfavorable to Boeing and that's why Boeing did it, that is a highly prejudicial or potentially highly prejudicial instruction, and that before those words can come out of the district court's mouth in an instruction, the court has to make its own findings that the party acted with bad faith and with an intent to deprive. And here, this was an accident. The record is completely lacking of any reason why Boeing would have done this. And the advisory committee notes also acknowledge that we don't know what was in that information. It could have been favorable to Boeing. We don't know. So as a matter of law, the court cannot allow the jury to infer that it was unfavorable to Boeing unless that critical gatekeeping criterion has been met, which is that Boeing intended to deprive Alabama Aircraft of its use in litigation. And that is wholly lacking on this record. And the district court acknowledged it by saying that he had to speculate. That's the substance of our position.
Thank you, Mr. Premis. Rebuttal, you have 5 minutes remaining. You're muted.
Here we go. I apologize for having to grab my power cord. All of a sudden my computer was about to go. But anyway, may it please the court, I do have a few points in rebuttal. And I think I'm going to go back to the court's question, and then I'm going to address, I'd like to address the reasons why the supplemental cases that we received last night are not really relevant, actually. And then finally, I'd like to, well, I want to touch on the fact that the tort at issue here is inextricably intertwined with the contract, and finally address what time I have to the spoliation issue. But going back to the question, there are a few other points to be made. Number one, on the supplemental authority, let's look at the Etheridge case that is Alabama Supreme Court, page 1327. It says law of the other state is of no consequence. Any other state, you look at what Alabama, what Alabama would say as to whether it is substantive or a procedural statute of limitations. And the test in Alabama, it's built in. If the statute of limitations is built into a substantive statute like we have here, the Trade Secrets Act, then it is substantive. That built-in phrase has been used a lot and interchangeably with this intertwined with the rights. Again, the case that I cited starting off with.
The counsel, your opposing counsel says there's another part of Etheridge that's important, and that is that whether the cause of action is a purely statutory one or whether it was a statutory one that's based on common law.
Right, Your Honor, thank you for asking that, because that was just what I was going to say as far as the difference between, if you look back at the Johnson versus BPS direct history, that's the proper analysis. That's the Alabama analysis. If you look at the more recent, the Reese case, it has the right result, but for the wrong reason. That was products liability, and that statute just looked at general statute of limitations law. It was not a built-in. And the Alabama Supreme Court is not looking as to whether there was some sort of, you know, prior kind of common law. And what I'd like to do now is to read to the court, as we were digging into this issue, the precatory language to the Uniform Trade Secrets Act. It notes that the contribution of these statutes, if you have a substantive statute like this, it's the substitution of unitary definitions in the statute, things like defining trade secret. It's a substitution of that, and it sets a single statute of limitations for various property, quasi-contractual, and violation of fiduciary relationship theories of non-contractual liability used at common law. And it displaces. And that's, there is a displacement section 417.463. It displaces these other things, these common law theories. It has a few exceptions to displacement, but this was meant to be a statutory creation, clear definition, new claims within it. So Reist is frankly, it's not the right standards. It's not the one that the Alabama Supreme Court uses. The Johnson case explains the history and the development of the standard in Alabama. We have a built-in statute of limitations here. Not only that, it was a legislative choice, decision by the legislature in Missouri to use a five-year statute. That's a public policy decision. Now, I'm not saying public policy standing alone is going to determine something, but I think it's very important. If you have a different statute of limitation, a more liberal one in Missouri, and that's what the legislature in that state wanted, that governs. Now, keep in mind, I'm switching over to the contractual issue. The NDA is a separate contract from the memorandum of agreement. The NDA says, do not misuse our proprietary information. That's contractual, yes, but it is inextricably intertwined with the tort of misappropriation of trade secrets, because that's how Boeing accessed. That's how they got PEMCO's proprietary information through that contract, and then they stole it. They stole it, and you can't separate the contract. And of course, the language is not as narrow as
I just want to be clear, Ms. Daniel, with the few moments you have left. You're not claiming that language incorporates all torts in the same way that a rising out of language does. What I understand you arguing, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is that the rights and obligations that it refers to are those that are raised by the NDA.
Well, yes. I mean, the rights and liabilities to the party. So the contract establishes the obligations, what they're supposed to do. Boeing was supposed to protect, firewall, not use for any other purpose, the trade secrets, proprietary information, but they violated that. So what are the liabilities? The liabilities are determined under the designated choice of law, and that's Missouri. And you just can't separate it out. They're trying to rewrite the contract, and we submit that, as we briefed, the contract is broad enough, certainly is broad enough under the case law that we cited. Now, I see it's red.
I'll give you another minute to address the spoliation issue.
So I've got the spoliation order, 20 pages. Detailed findings by the court. Details. It sets it out what they did, how they went in and deleted, you know, the top guys, the guys that were making the pricing decisions, the guys that got the information. This Boeing bid on, I don't know, $1 billion contract came in 1%.
Was it appropriate to submit the question to the jury?
Yes, Your Honor. Boeing fought hard for that. We wanted to rest on the order. We had a sanctions order, and Boeing said, you know, they that was so watered down, submitting it to the jury. Boeing was arguing commentary to the rule. We felt that we already had spoliation established if you look at the language of Rule 37. So that and like the other jury instruction at issue in their cross appeal, that that was so watered down from what we submitted and asked the court to do it. Actually, the court was ruling in Boeing's favor on both those issues. It's sort of astounding to see this cross appeal where things were submitted to the jury and there's no harmful error there. There's just an incredible amount of evidence that this data was intentionally deleted because it goes to the heart of our claim.
Thank you, Ms. Daniel.
All right, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel, for your very helpful arguments in this case.